first case on calendar this morning is docket number 61936, Williams versus Millard. Mr. Sterling, are you ready to begin?
I am, Your Honor, and if I could just have maybe 30 seconds or a minute before we start the clock.
Sure.
Good morning, Justice Cherry and Justice Douglas. I just wanted to note that this is a part of the pro bono program, which I had some hand in creating as one of the founding members of the appellate practice section. And although I'm not the appointed pro bono attorney in this particular case, I have taken several of these cases. I do think it's a valuable program, and I want to thank the court for taking the extra time that it does in these cases. And also to point out that because of the nature of the case and some of the extra time it takes to do these pro bono cases, I've waived my fee as well in this case.
Great. Well, and you know, the program helps us as well. It helps us reach issues that we wouldn't ordinarily be able to get to that are important to the bench and the bar. So it's thank you. Would you like to reserve any time, first of all?
I'm going to try to reserve 5 minutes. If I get 2 minutes, I'll be happy.
Okay.
My client, Bo Sterling, on behalf of the appellant, Dolores Williams. Dolores Williams is the grandmother of two children who are now five and a little bit under 9 years old now. She took care of the children when they were younger, and after the sad and unfortunate death of her daughter, Andra, in 2010. And that's really the genesis of what this case is about. Andra and the respondent, Mr. Millard in this case, were not married. When Andra died, Mr. Millard and my client Dolores Williams took care of the children together for a time, but shortly thereafter, Mr. Millard married Tatiana Harris.
Mr. Sterling?
Yes.
In this, we're very sensitive to grandparents' rights and such, but in this particular case, we have an intervening adoption. How does, what's the interplay of this petition by the grandmother versus the adoption, and does that not divest the court?
The short answer is no, it does not divest the court of jurisdiction. At a minimum, that's because the way the statute is set up, as long as the motion or the petition for the grandparents' rights is brought before the adoption is finalized, then
I don't quite see that in the statute. Can you read that to me?
Well, the statute, and I'm going to have the text in front of me when I do this, so I don't misstate it, but we're talking about what was known in 1999 as the Grandparents' Bill of Rights, and it's now NRS 125C.050, and it talks very specifically about, except as otherwise provided in this section, if a parent of an unmarried minor child, and so far that's what we have here, is deceased, that subsection A, that would cover a mom or has had his or her parental rights terminated, which I guess eventually happened when the adoption is finalized, so we may be under that provision as well. It says the district court may grant the great-grandparents and grandparents of the child a reasonable right to visit the child during the child's minority. And I skipped a little bit of it there, but I don't think I skipped anything that changes the meaning of it. But basically what it says is that if you have a deceased parent, then the court can award visitation to the grandparents or the great-grandparents.
Let me ask you this, going back to the timing of this.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding and correct me if I'm wrong, is that her petition was filed one day prior to the hearing on the adoption. Her complaint was filed.
That's my understanding. Now, the adoption proceedings are sealed. I was involved in them, right. But I'm hesitant to get too much into that. But that's certainly what the court represented in the order for supplemental briefing. I think we
And once the adoption occurred, didn't the court wasn't the court divested of jurisdiction? That essentially is what Justice Douglas asked, and I'm still I don't think the question was answered, at least to my satisfaction.
And the problem is the intervention of 127-171 basically referring to the fact that normally you have an order in place prior to adoption, and then that right of the grandparent would carry over, but where you have no right in place.
Yes. That is certainly the issue that respondent has raised and the court latched onto as well. Now you're bringing it up again, and let me address it directly, and now I've got 127.171 in front of me, and it would seem to be consistent with what you're saying. So arguably, anyway, we have a conflict between these two statutes. We have the Grandparents' Bill of Rights that's very specifically intended to give rights to the grandparents under the circumstances that I believe we have here. And then we have this older statute that goes back many, many years, which would seem to contradict the newer statute. And it's a well-established rule of statutory construction or interpretation that when you have conflicting statutes or arguably conflicting statutes, you normally go to the newer one, the more specific one, and you give that one effect. And that's what we've asked the court to do in this case, is to give the Grandparents' Bill of Rights statute the effect that it was intended specifically to have under these narrow circumstances, as opposed to the more general statute that dates back to an earlier date. And it honestly wasn't intended to deal with grandparents.
Well, I'm saying
originally had no
rights. I hesitate to interrupt you, but to going back to 127-171, and how that interacts with 125C050. Again, the fact that there's a statute permitting post-adoption visitation rights that may be granted to the grandparent, but only those rights that had been previously established under 125050. And in this case, what were those rights?
Under previously established under 125C050. I'm not sure I entirely understood the question, because I'm going to answer it by being repetitive, which is that the specific statute prevails over the more general statute. So perhaps if I could ask you to ask the question another way. Perhaps repeat it. Maybe I didn't hear the first part.
Well, I'm trying to figure out. The statute does permit post-adoption visitation rights that were in place prior to the adoption, is the way that I'm looking at this, that were established pursuant to 125C050.
Yes.
And in this case, there were no rights.
Well, I'm not seeing, I'm disagreeing with you in the reading of this statute as requiring a prior determination. It's based on the best interest of the child,
which the district court specifically went through, and there was a presumption that was not overcome, that the visitation was in the child's best interests. for a number of reasons that I'm not going to discuss. Facts and a part of the record.
And I'm sympathetic to that argument, of course, because those are ordinarily discretionary kinds of decisions, as this court well knows. Under the circumstances, what the court is really saying, if you look at the order itself, which does not provide any specific findings, I would argue, and I think the record reflects it, is that the court was not applying the statute.
Well, why don't you argue why it's in the best interest of these children to still have contact with their grandparents, grandmother? Give us the fact. Make the argument as if you're in district court.
I'm not in district court very often, Your Honor, but I'm happy to make that argument. And I can point to two very specific things. One is that Dolores Williams indeed cared for the children before the death of her daughter, the children's mother, and developed a strong bond with those children. And after Andra's death, continued to have that relationship with the children, both in a bonding, caring way, and also as a caregiver.
Give us the dates as to when she first started taking care of the children with her daughter, and then when did her daughter die, and then how long after her daughter's death did she care for the children?
Well, Andra died on October 7, 2010. And my understanding is that the caregiving role went back several years before that with regard to the older child, because the younger child was only about a year old at that time, if I'm doing the math correctly. And I'm not sure how long it continued afterwards until Tatiana Harris came into the picture. But it was enough to build a bond. And also, if you go back and look at the legislative history behind the Grandparents' Bill of Rights, and this is nothing that would come as a surprise to the court, there was a lot of testimony and a lot of agreement, and the whole purpose of the statute as it was presented was because grandparents often do have a very powerful and important bond with their grandchildren, and especially in this day and age with mixed families, you often have the grandparents taking a primary role.
When did the Mallards get married?
I don't have that date in front of me, Your Honor, but it was, well, the respondent can probably address that, but it was shortly after Andra died. But long enough afterwards where there was still some time when Ms. Williams was providing care. You know, and I want to back up when I have just a little bit of time here left and talk about the adoption statute, because although it's not part of the record in this case, I think the court is perhaps aware of adoption being used not infrequently as a sword to deny the rights of grandparents and even parents. And part of that comes about because although notice is required to be given during the adoption, the timelines are often short and people don't know their rights. And this court has over and over again said you can't come in and intervene after the adoption order. So, you know, the attorney down below did the right thing here as best he could and tried to file the petition before the adoption was finalized, because even though you have a final order on the adoption, it can always relate back to the earlier time before it was entered. And that's what we're asking here.
Any comment about there's a case, birth mother versus adoptive parents, 118 Nevada, deals with family rights and potentially being cut off during the adoption if nothing is stated?
The rule is if you don't bring it up during the adoption, then you lose that right. Here it was brought up during the adoption. And so under Bopp versus Luno, 1994 case before the statute, jurisdiction is preserved. It's the opposite situation from Bopp v. Luno when it was too late. I'm going to reserve a minute and 26 seconds, if I may, unless you have another question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Smith, you ready?
I am.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Let me start off with an easy question to you. Why is it in the best interest of these children to have visitation rights with their grandmother?
Sorry, Your Honor, did you say why it is or isn't?
Why it isn't.
Why it isn't. Justice Perry alluded to some of the information that's been in the pleadings in this case, and this is just on the pleadings at this stage. There was no NRS 125C.050 hearing at this point from an evidentiary standpoint, but the district court, William Gonzalez, had familiarity with these parties and the allegations in the pleadings and in Ms. Williams' complaint, and found that the allegations and the evidence before him didn't suffice to rebut the presumption that Mr. Mallard's denial of visitation was reasonable. And that presumption has to be rebutted under the statute by clear and convincing evidence.
Okay, now be a little more specific. That was great generalization. Now be specific to me.
Sure.
Then like I'm a fourth grader, and you're going to tell me why this grandma should not see these children.
Yes, Your Honor. Judge Gonzalez specifically referenced at the hearing, which is in the supplemental appendix, the allegations where Ms. Williams wrongfully diverted the children's Social Security benefits to herself. There was a lot of litigation letters back and forth, which are in the record in this case, primarily in Mr. Mallard's opposition to her motion, demonstrating that diversion of Social Security benefits was wrongful. There's been allegations of false police reports made back and forth, false allegations of sexual abuse in this case, which Judge Williams noted were found to be not true. And so with that background and the relationship between the parties and the disruptive nature, allegations of Ms. Williams coaching the children to be disparaging of Mr. Mallard's new spouse, that he found that against that background, further visitation was not in the child's best interest. Addressing Justice Peregrine and Justice Douglas' question regarding the NRS 127.171, that statute does divest the district court of jurisdiction to hear any concurrently pending adoption proceeding once an adoption has been finalized. In this case, Ms. Williams filed her complaint on May 9th, 2012, one day before the adoption was finalized on May 10th, 2012. When she filed her complaint, that the court did have jurisdiction under NRS 125C.050 because she petitioned after the death of Ms. Petway. However, the next day when the adoption decree was entered, the district court was divested of jurisdiction. NRS 127.160 creates a new legal family upon the entry of an adoption decree and severs and abrogates all ties between the child's natural parents and natural grandparents. NRS 127.171, the crucial language of which states that in an adoption proceeding, a district court may grant a reasonable right to visitation to certain relatives, in this case a grandparent. The crucial language is only if a similar right had been granted previously. Although Ms. Williams filed her complaint one day before, on the day of the adoption on May 10th, she did not have any rights granted previously. Merely filing the petition did not confer her with any visitation rights at the time. Therefore, when the district court heard and decided Ms. Williams' complaint in August 2012, the district court was divested of jurisdiction. In Bopp versus Luno, this court recognized that NRS 127.171 acts as a jurisdictional limitation on a grandparent's right to obtain visitation. The court specifically noted that the legislature would not have enacted NRS 127.171 if the district court had unfettered jurisdiction to grant visitation rights following an adoption. This result was in accordance with the cases of other jurisdictions, specifically the Ohio Supreme Court in the Kalo decision. There, a husband and wife had a child and subsequently divorced. The father was awarded custody and his new spouse petitioned to adopt the child. On the day of the adoption hearing, so one day later than even occurred in this case, the natural mother filed an emergency motion in the Ohio Domestic Relations Court for visitation rights. The adoption is subsequently entered, and the father moved to dismiss the visitation action on the same grounds that Mr. Mallard advances here, that the entry of an adoption decree divested that court of jurisdiction to continue to hear the visitation request. The lower court denied that motion, writs ensued, and the Ohio Supreme Court relied on the statute very similar to NRS 127.160. The Ohio equivalent is RC 3107.15. Both of those statutes, again, create a new legal family at the time of the interim adoption decree and sever all ties between a parent, a natural parent and grandparents, and their children. The Ohio Supreme Court, relying upon that statute, held that the entry of an adoption decree divested the domestic relations court of jurisdiction to continue to hear the visitation requests.
Counsel, let's come back to it's almost fundamental. Mr. Sterling made the argument that is, the legislature enacted grandparents' rights with the intent of giving grandparents some rights. Why shouldn't that trump the other presumptions in this particular case?
These statutes should be read in light of the common law. We should recall that at common law, grandparents had no rights whatsoever to visit or see their grandchildren. So to the extent grandparents have any right to see their grandchildren, they are creatures of statute. And the statutes that have been enacted strike the balance that the legislature deemed appropriate to balance grandparents' rights to see the children and a parent's right to deny a grandparent access. And the balance that has been struck here is embodied in NRS 127.171, which states that a grandparent may petition for visitation rights if they've had those rights granted previously. Now, it's also important to note that even if a grandparent did have visitation granted previously to them following a divorce, separation, or even death of a parent, the court, NRS 127.171, still gives a court discretion to deny the continuation of those visitation rights. That statute still says a court may grant a reasonable right to visit following an adoption proceeding. It does not have to, even if a grandparent had pre-existing visitation rights. So, generally speaking, or in a number of cases, children would benefit from having relations with their grandparents. That's not always the case, and this is one of those cases. So, in light of the common law background, grandparents don't have a right except by creature of statute, and these statutes say that any visitation rights have to be granted previously, and Ms. Williams did not have any rights granted previously.
Let me ask you this. Going back to the issue of the best interests of the children, Mr. Sterling indicated that those findings weren't specifically made in this case. Is that the case? And if it is the case, what's our what are we to do with that? And assuming it's not the case, isn't our standard of review and abuse of discretion for what the judge determined to be in the child's best interests?
I would agree that the standard of review is abuse of discretion to determine what's in the child's best interest. And the district court in this proceeding did specifically make findings that in his review of the record and the evidence before him, it was not in the children's best interest. The specific testimony can be found at the hearing transcript, which is in the supplemental appendix at page 36 through 37, and again on page 40, where the court specifically noted that in his review of the records and the relationship and interaction amongst the parties, Mr. Williams' denial of visitation was reasonable under these circumstances.
Partly due, I think he stated, because of the acrimonious relationship.
That's correct, Your Honor. A second basis for affirmance here is that upon entry of the adoption decree, Ms. Williams no longer had standing to pursue visitation rights. When the adoption decree was entered on May 10, 2012, Ms. Williams ceased to be a legal relative of the children. As this court also recognized in Bott versus Leno, following the entry of adoption, an ex-relative, there is no statute in Nevada that permits an ex-relative to petition for visitation rights. Bott versus Leno specifically stated that once an adoption is entered, a grandparent no longer has standing to pursue visitation. Finally, in the court's order requesting supplemental briefing, the court asked the parties to address whether the district court properly took judicial notice of the adoption proceeding. NRS 47.130 and 47.150 allows the district court discretion to take judicial notice of facts that are commonly known in the jurisdiction or easily verifiable from sources whose accuracy cannot reasonably be questioned. While the general rule is that courts do not take judicial notice of the court record in other proceedings, that rule is a flexible one, and if cases are closely enough connected, it's not an abuse of discretion to take judicial notice. Here, Ms. Williams' complaint and the adoption proceedings are closely related, both pertaining to the custodial and parental rights over these two children. The entry of one affects the other. Indeed, again, Judge Gonzalez was the same judge that presided over both proceedings. He presided over the adoption proceeding and Ms. Williams' complaint. He specifically referenced the fact of the adoption that he entered on page 34 of the supplemental appendix when denying Ms. Williams' request at the hearing. Judge Gonzalez was not required to ignore something he had firsthand knowledge of and of facts of the adoption that were easily verifiable in his own records. Another point, 47.160 allows a party to be heard, request to be heard on the propriety of taking judicial notice. In the district court, neither Ms. Williams nor her counsel objected to the district court's taking judicial notice of the adoption that he entered. None of the parties dispute that an adoption was actually entered in this case. So because the cases are closely connected and there was no objection in the lower court, the district court did not abuse its discretion by taking judicial notice of the adoption proceeding. And unless the court has any other questions?
Either one of you?
No.
I respectfully request the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Sterling, you got a minute and 24 seconds left.
Briefly, the district court didn't make any specific findings. There was a hearing. It was not a formal hearing on the statute issue 125C.050. There were some ruminations and speculation and some off-the-cuff kind of statements, but there was never any formal findings as to the best interests of the child and that sort of thing as would be required to actually have a proper exercise of discretion in this case. So if the court is thinking about remanding it for proper findings, that would be one possible remedy. The same thing with the so-called taking judicial notice. I'm not sure how much that is relevant to the issues in this appeal, but again, taking judicial notice of something is a relatively formal process that has to provide notice to the other side, and there has to be some specific findings made, and that wasn't done in this case.
But, counsel, you were not counsel of record down below, but there was no objection to that judicial notice that was taken.
Well, I don't think it was judicial notice. That's what I'm saying, Your Honor. And again, those are sealed proceedings that weren't part of this, and that's always a complication.
And this is a very unique situation because you had the same judge that handled that.
I understand that, but you still have to have some separation, really, to have due process. But that's all I have, Your Honor.
All right. Very good. And, counsel, thank you both for your very fine arguments in the briefing in this case. These are very difficult. Often tragic cases. They're hard for us to decide. They're difficult for all of you, but we will get a decision out shortly.
Thank you.
This case will stand submitted. We'll